What's up? Let's cut to the chase and take an honest look at the big fat elephant in the room. We live in global crisis times. Time is ticking as ecosystems around the world are collapsing before our very eyes. All the while in the richest nations, there is a severe mental breakdown caused by the deterioration of the community fabric that once knitted us all together. We also stand at a point of the convergence or resetting, if you will, of many cycles, such as the generational cycle, as accompanied by major social, political, and economic upheaval every about 80 years. This, by the way, is described in great detail in an excellent book called The Fourth Turning. Very good. I highly recommend it. We also have the cycle of credit expansion and contraction every 60 to 70 years. The East-West cycle every 500 years as times of, you know, renaissance and power cycle back and forth between the Western world and Asia. I could go on and on and on. But then I start to ponder and ask, should we freak out? No. Never allow fear to take root and establish itself as the monoculture weed in your mind and spirit. Nah. Let's instead be the white wolf of our spirit, its daily dose of hope and vision. And plus, there's actually more to celebrate than to despair. It's all a matter of perspective and what you can see. And I don't know about you, but I can see a great view ahead. I guess you can call me an apocaloptimist. I attribute a lot of this optimism from the sheer number of sustainable development projects I've personally been involved with, or the several eco-village in which I've immersed myself in. And I could tell you, there's great polarity in today's times. The good news is that as these crises deepen, so does the good work on the other end of the spectrum. The decision is yours. So I invite you to look with me into the world of eco-village development, beginning with Jonathan Dawson's book, Eco-Villages, New Frontiers for Sustainability. Bom dia, buenos dias. Welcome to Ecovillage Library. I'm your host, Christopher Kinney, and I'm here to summarize for you great works being produced within the wonderful world of sustainable living, resiliency, ecovillage, community living, you name it. My background is in sustainable development engineering, and most of my working and learning years have been spent with sustainable communities throughout the Americas, Europe, and Asia. These communities range from a spearfishing indigenous village to small family farms to self-organized eco-villages. And each place I've been to has really influenced me in their own particular way. And it's funny because as I traveled from place to place, I challenged myself to keep the habit of leaving something behind as a gift once I left and continued on with my journey. And there were a handful of places which I forgot to do this. And every time this happened, I unintentionally forgot something and left it behind. And funny enough, when I did remember to leave behind a gift, I never forgot anything. It was easy to say this was all coincidence until it happened for like the fifth time to me. Anyway, the goal here was intentionality. In case you are unfamiliar with the term, intentionality is defined as the act of being deliberate or purposeful, giving meaning to experience and creating the capacity for empathy. I was motivated to start carrying through with this habit after seeing so many other people practicing it, and my spirit felt drawn to this sort of thing. So during my travels, one of my main curiosities was to see what this looks like in a community setting where everyone's practicing intentionality with whom they're living with. And it's definitely not all roses, in case you were wondering. After taking a peek down this rabbit hole, I quickly realized that there are so many dimensions to community living. We as humans are complicated as hell. When I traveled to the Scottish Highlands to study eco-village design through the Gaia program with Finhorn Eco-Village, I was surprised by how much emphasis was weighed on the unseen dimensions of eco-village living. One mentor of mine described it as a graduate's course in applied sociology. But don't get me wrong, we just as well cover the other elements in great depth. In fact, there are four dimensions of eco-village design, or in a broader sense, sustainability, which are ecological sustainability, economic sustainability, social sustainability, and cultural sustainability. And before I go any further, you may be screaming for a formalized definition, or maybe not, but I'll give it to you anyways, because now seems like the perfect time. The definition that is mentioned in the book comes from the Gilman's Report, which was basically the written out conclusion of a study done in 1990 to determine the best practices of sustainable communities. Their conclusions were organized as a series of recommendations on how to make the eco-village movement make the transition from the experimentation stage to the takeoff stage and beyond. From this report, they define an eco-village as being a human-scale, full-featured settlement in which human activities are harmlessly integrated into the natural world in a way that is supportive of healthy human development and can be successfully continued into the indefinite future. The author states that eco-villages unite two profound truths: that human life is at its best in small, supportive, healthy communities, and that the only sustainable path for humanity is in the recovery and refinement of traditional life. But this doesn't mean retreating into an idealized past, but rather to create a new synthesis that would draw on the best of human expertise in treading lightly on the earth, community-level governance, and the application of modern energy-efficient technologies. So going back into our four dimensions, we first have ecological sustainability, which seems to me as the easiest to achieve in my mind. This basically means access to food, shelter, water, and energy, which respects the cycles of nature. Economic sustainability drives a bit deeper. It is the antithesis of our global debt-based fiat Ponzi scheme that currently dominates our world and every country of today. The eco-village approach is an alternative to this. You can see eco-villages as lifeboats because this giant monetary system is coming down. There's absolutely no way it could sustain itself much longer. Dawson says, the movement to create eco-villages is perhaps the most comprehensive antidote to dependence on the global economy. So being central to eco-village economics, you'll see local currencies, sharing, social entrepreneurship, collaborative forms of ownership, and basically a circular economy. Now, for social sustainability, this is all about building trust, collaboration, and openness between people and providing a sense of belonging and empowerment. Studying this at Finhorn Eco-Village, we were trained in techniques like empathetic communication, conflict facilitation, participatory leadership and governance, inclusive, responsive, and transparent decision-making. And so in the book, Jonathan Dawson says that the social dimension is perhaps the most important, but also the most difficult to get right due to the enormous challenge of finding satisfactory and inclusive forms of community governance and well-being. He says, this is among the most challenging tasks faced by eco-villages and lies at the root of the collapse of most. Three principal efforts are highlighted as follows. 1, promoting a culture of trust and compassion. 2, creating effective decision-making procedures, and 3, working with conflict. This aspect is so important. There's a really good book written solely to address this challenge written by Diana Leif Christensen called Creating a Life Together. But we'll go over that another time. And finally, there's the cultural element of sustainability. This is the one that is always left out from those phony triple bottom line discussions you hear from those still trying to operate within this collapsing paradigm. This is what keeps the fire going for generations. This is where intentionality becomes a way of life. This is where you'll see the human spirit flourish and bloom into practices, celebrations, ways of life as diverse as every snowflake that's ever come to rest on the Earth's surface. Cultural sustainability means there is a deep connection with a higher purpose in life. Mindfulness and personal growth are properly nurtured in art and any kind of creative expression are embraced. So, taking a step back, where are we? Well, we're in many places. The good news is that there are an ever-increasing amount of eco-villages claiming their existence in the world of today. The Global Eco-Village Network has literally thousands already officially listed. And the not-so-good news is that time is running out and the challenges to becoming 100% independent as an eco-village are extreme. The Gilman report identified these challenge areas as being integration into the biosystem, built environment, economy, governance, glue or values, and whole system integration. Main challenges is the returning to a community way of life. The author lays out, community integrity has been steamrolled by economic policies favoring mass production and distribution and the free flow of capital across the globe. Meanwhile, increases in the rates of crime, depression, drug abuse, and suicide are sure indicators of the growing alienation and lack of moral guidance experienced by many. So, the big challenge facing the eco-village movement today is to find, as he says, creative ways of responding to the very problems to which mainstream society is crying out for solutions and of building bridges to more mainstream organizations and initiatives. Thus, the biggest ideals behind the eco-village movement today are those from what the author calls Gandhian principles of self-reliance, decentralization, and spiritual inquiry. In Senegal, a country now transforming over literally 14,000 villages into established eco-villages as outlined by Global Eco-Village Network, declares that becoming an eco-village is no less than the act of reclaiming spiritual and cultural integrity, pride in tradition, heritage of mutual aid, community solidarity, self-reliance, and self-respect. It was really interesting to read about some of the historical examples of some eco-villages in the past that Dawson shed light on, where apparently the first recorded intentional community was developed by Pythagoras in about 525 BC. But then it says that biblical scholars argue that the first intentional community from their view was recorded much earlier in 8th century BC, outlining a guy named Amos as the first recorded intentional community designer. And these were just a few of many examples, but mind you, this is through the lens of Western civilization. When you take into account other cultures and other times, the endless showcase of examples will inevitably reveal our original way of life. Nowadays, there are many great modern examples to learn from. As Dawson describes in his book, the eco-villages of today can be categorized as mainly two types. The first type is low-tech, where a conscious attempt is made to reduce the use of fossil fuels, to simply design and reduce needs and costs, and to make as much use as possible of locally available and recycled materials. Now, the other type of eco-village is high-tech, which involves the use of state-of-the-art ecological technologies, even though these are often more expensive. And I've personally spent time within both types. On the high end, I would consider those I visited in Europe, which was Findhorn and Tamara in Portugal. Tamara was very neat because they were in fact inventing their own technologies with their own patents and everything. And when I was there, I was shown their Stirling engine that they created, which essentially is almost a free lunch, engineeringly speaking. This means that almost no energy is used for a given power output. Now, Tamara's Stirling engine was able to capture and reuse most of the heat directed towards it, which was their own vegetable oil solution stored within the reflective aluminum beams of the greenhouse they constructed located nearby. So this solution is heated by the concentrated rays of the sun and thus are directed to the Stirling engine. And as part of the system, and to make the Stirling engine work, they also had colder water coming in from the pond they built themselves, of which the temperature differential drove the engine's functionality. As for the low-tech eco-villages I spent time in, there were two in particular in Colombia and Brazil. The one in Brazil was the first eco-village I've been to, and they were a yoga eco-village. You know, everyone there was on a whole other level with yoga. Let me tell you, I was quite impressed by their discipline and mutual practice. You know, everyone was on the same page. They were getting up at 4 a.m. every morning practicing yoga. And it definitely helps to constantly be around those who are after what you're after, you know? This was a pleasant introduction for me into this whole world and existence of eco-villages. You know, I remember talking to one of the older guys there and asked him, you know, hey, why is there a human skull there on the kitchen window? And he said, I take it with me when I retreat to the jungle to meditate in the middle of the night. And I said to myself, man, this guy is a whole other level. I don't know why, but I'm sure he's got his reasons. And yeah, they were nice people. When you're around people who are such on that kind of level, you feel it, and it's contagious, and it inevitably affects you. And what I really resonated with was that once a day, every week, this particular community made the commitment to serve the greater community, outside of which they did a lot of work and mentoring with the local schools and such. Now, the other eco-village in Colombia where I was invited to my first sweat lodge ceremony, this was after being there for about a month during their biannual Latin American eco-village convergence, where, you know, many of the eco-village members and leaders of around the eco-villages in Latin America came together and would teach each other best practices, but mostly within the social realm, like decision-making techniques like sociocracy, which is a unique form of dynamic governance and distributed leadership. So I highly encourage you to look that up. It's really cool. But the author also mentions one really interesting eco-village I haven't been to yet called Auroville in India. It's one of the largest eco-villages on record with over 2,400 residents. It has a flourishing community economy where there are about 125 enterprises, all owned by the collective, all involved in the manufacture and retailing of handicrafts, computers, and food, together with building, energy, waste treatment technologies. And the author also mentions another one in Brazil called Ecovila and their own innovative system where they have their dwellings cooled by airflow through a system of subterranean chambers and above ground galleries that are also used for growing herbs, spices, and vines. And this is a perfect example of a term you may hear a lot of called appropriate technology, essentially being small-scale technology that is simply enough for the average person to manage on his own without having to depend on somebody with extra special knowledge. And these are primarily employed, especially by villages in the quote-unquote global south, which is a term used a lot to refer to the lower-income nations, most of which are south of the equator. Then on the other side of the paradigm lies the global north, the home front of consumerism, I guess you could say. So looking at our current world paradigm, the reasons and strategies of eco-village development varies across the board. But at the end of the day, they're essentially evolving towards the same thing. One particular strategy that is more common in the global north is the development of co-housing communities, where a number of households cluster together and members share meals and resources like laundry, garden tools, etc. This has been pioneered heavily in Europe, especially during the experimentation stage, but Dawson describes that the original pioneers of this were most dissatisfied because this wasn't radical enough. People in these co-housing communities were still living fairly conventional lifestyles, but I like how Graham Metzler, an architect I learned from at Finhorn, he said about co-housing that it's the mainstream option and intentionally so. And the original drive behind all of this remains constant throughout. This is chronic loneliness, depression, and lack of meaning, most of which being what ultimately drives the development of the eco-village movement in the global north. Now, let's put differences aside and compare the common threads that link the global north and south eco-village initiatives. First, their developments both attempt to regain control over community resources taken away by corporations. Second, the biggest pain points motivating both sides are cultural and economic in nature. Both want cultural renewal and economic empowerment. And I know at first I used to always ask, what's the real meaning behind an eco-village? Does its concept retain any coherence? And I thought Dawson answered this quite well as he laid out what he calls the fundamental attributes, which really, in my mind, fills the meaning of what an eco-village is all about and what they seek to achieve. First and foremost is community. The eco-village is a response to the alienation and solitude of modern living and to the hunger for a reconnection with others in meaningful community. Second is resilience. I really liked what Dawson wrote for this part, saying, the eco-village is a citizen initiative entirely reliant on the resources, imagination, and vision of the community members themselves. The eco-village is a business of gaining back control over their own resources and their own destinies. In the Global South, control over resources between corporations and communities is very evident. Water is diverted away from small-scale farms to feed monoculture plantations and golf courses. Traditional fishermen watch powerless while factory ships suck up their catch. Tourist hotels throw out their pollution of sex abuse and prostitution while undermining vitality and self-confidence. In the Global North, local economies are flattened out by out-of-town supermarkets, leaving consumers with little choice but to buy products that demean workers and degrade ecosystems around the world. The process of economic globalization has severely undercut the viability of local economies. Corporate subsidies and unfair trade arrangements have further perpetuated this debt-based fiat global economy in which huge volumes of produce are shipped hither and thither across the world. This delivers profits to the corporations that control production and distribution while undermining the communities, local economies, and ecosystems alike. So, the eco-village is a direct response to all of this. They stand as a strong impulse towards voluntary simplicity, consciously deciding to live more simply, so others may simply live, as Mother Teresa would say. They also stand as a strong impulse to redefine the relationship to work, not as a chore, but an act of service and enjoyment. When I was in Finhorn, they replaced the word work altogether with love in action. The heart of the matter is, the eco-village is created in opposition to globalization, an attempt to win back some measure of community control, how we grow our food, build our houses, generate our energy, create our livelihoods, entertain ourselves and each other. So the next fundamental attribute is spirituality, a strong body of shared values. It's the most important, but unfortunately the most taboo. Some eco-villages like to define spirituality for themselves as something along the lines of being, you know, free thinking and tolerant towards diverse beliefs, etc. Oroville's approach to this was defining a shared commitment amongst members being ecological restoration, rebuilding community, and service to others. Another example from Kommun Niederkufungen in Germany, I don't speak German, but I think that's close enough, is quoted, quote unquote, to be a model of cooperation, equality, equity, and productivity, and promote world peace and ecological sustainability. And the final attribute he lays out is center of research, demonstration, and training. Each eco-village has its own specific field of expertise, whether that's hemp cultivation, mangrove restoration, appropriate technology, sustainability education, low impact living, etc. An eco-village in Tennessee called The Farm has engaged in a whole bunch of ecological restoration projects such as riparian repairs and watershed protection, preservation of land for conservation, forest reseeding, highland prairie management, wildlife identification and protection. This all then successfully prevents those wanting to come in and log and develop subdivisions. And I fortunately found myself involved in one such project in Scotland with the Trees of Life affiliated with Finhorn. And it was pretty cool working with their nursery. They had about 1 million trees, or that was their goal. And literally, you were able to see their progress over the course of several decades of trees they planted 20, 30 years ago, something along those lines, and it was incredible to see the impacts, because the Scottish Highlands forest is now only to 1% of what it used to be. And so there's a real effort made, spearheaded by this guy, leading Trees for Life. So it was really cool to see that. I am really fascinated by the endless list of opportunities and projects that an eco-village can achieve. I know it's easy to revert back to economic pessimism and say, well, hey, this sounds great and all, but how in the world are we able to pull something like this off financially and keep it afloat, you know, economically speaking? Well, I'll do say that it's more than possible, and I've seen and studied so many success stories. Again, just like starting out with anything, you just got to start with the seed and start small. Like the little creek of life that you generate, and it gains more traction as it joins and links up with other creeks, thus becoming a river of life. But start small and get moving. I know Earth Haven Eco Village in North Carolina leases and subsidizes their land to community members at knockdown rates, essentially providing the boost for members to launch different agricultural initiatives like rotational grazing on pasture or biodynamic vegetable market gardening business. But whatever your particular situation, there are millions of business venture possibilities like publishing houses, printing presses, organic farming, solar panel manufacturing, organic tree nursery and reforestation project, Airbnb, wastewater system designing, being a consultant company, being a restaurant, candle factory, herbal soap factory, a weaving studio, ceramic studio, workshop, or woodwork workshop, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which ones particularly interest you? You know, which ones interest somebody you already know? You know, link up, get something happening, start rolling together. There's a strong tradition also of eco-village-based renewable energy enterprises. I know when I was in Finnhorn, they built themselves incredible windmills, of which they earned an income from the excess energy they produced. You can also develop a consulting company. You know, pulling another example from Finnhorn, I met Michael Shaw, who was an engineer who founded the Biomatrix Water Solutions Company, which provides ecological engineering for waterway restoration and wastewater treatment. And not only within Scotland, but also in the Philippines, India, US, and China. And you know, it all starts and reinforces itself back at home in the eco-village. Biomatrix Water is the perfect example because back in the day in Finnhorn, they built their own wastewater treatment plant, which was designed to ecologically treat with plants the sewage of 500 plus people living in the eco-village. This then developed as a perfect base from which to research, educate, and promote ecological water treatment technology throughout the world. And this leads to the point that the core activity and largest single source of income for many intentional communities is education. This forms the bedrock of many eco-village economies. The book also states that the area in which eco-villages have perhaps had the greatest success and creating bridges to the mainstream society is in the area of education. I myself have paid for such educational programs, not only at Finnhorn, but also in Latin America with communities getting off the ground. And to give you an example, you know, when I was in Colombia, a bunch of friends of mine, we were all going to take a permaculture design course being offered at an inspiring eco-village in Manizales. So I decided to tag along with them, and the place we went to was a family farm that had the vision of becoming an eco-village themselves. So they got some really good permaculture teachers, you know, throughout Latin America to host the course, and we paid for the course as we learned through hands-on applications, which thus exponentially pushed this small family farm closer towards their goal. And from my end, it was a fantastic experience. I have also seen this many times with natural building courses as well. You know, a community wants to build a natural building and pulls it off by, you know, providing education to those who are seeking the knowledge and experience. It's a win-win situation and thus continues to be a reliable strategy everywhere. But this, you know, is mostly the informal example. there is a huge strive being made in the realm of formalized eco-village education. The biggest example I can personally draw from is, again, the eco-village design education course I mentioned earlier, which is now being endorsed by UNESCO as being, you know, being an important element of the UN Decade of Education for Sustainable Development. So they, you know, whatever Findhorn's doing in the eco-village design education curriculum coursework is being recognized by the United Nations, which is pretty cool. Now, once businesses are created and income is being generated, it's important to keep the economy local and from being sucked out into the black hole of the illusionary global economy. Dawson says, local currency and strong purchasing power remains in the community when local investment is combined with local ownership, local production, and local employment. And since most eco-villages provide considerable employment on site, there tends to be a significantly reduced need for transport as well, thus further reducing the need to consume and spend more. And this is one of the striking features of most eco-villages, being their holistic and integrated character, enabling them to increase internal research resource flows and thereby reducing their need for external inputs. So far I've been rambling on all about the whys and hows of eco-villages, but in order to come full circle, I feel it's appropriate to mention its challenges as well. As explained in the book, there are challenges from two fronts, from the outside and from the inside. So let's talk about the outside first. The more popular eco-villages are becoming, unfortunately, the concept still remains largely peripheral to the mainstream society, showing very little strides towards actual sustainability, which has become a misconstrued buzzword these days, unfortunately. One particular challenge in the global north, at least, are tremendously high prices for land and for permission to do just about anything. Findhorn says that they spent more money on gaining permission to have their windmills than it actually costed to obtain, transport, and install the windmill. So regulations around banking as well and community currencies have also tightened its chokehold, making it much more difficult for community initiatives to flourish. And this reminds me of the book by Joel Salatin called Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, which essentially calls out and shows how the system, at least within the realm of farming, favors industrial global corporate food systems and discourages community-based food commerce. Now, for the eco-villages in the countries of the global south, Dawson lays out the growing challenges as being three factors at play. One, more and more areas of food production are being taken out of community control and are turned into plantation agriculture for the global market and tourism. This has led to a mass exodus of working-age people to the urban slums as communities no longer have control over the land and water they once did. Two, the tentacles of the global media have greatly increased their reach, carrying messages, glamorizing consumerism, and undermining traditional values and lifestyles into all but the most isolated communities. You know, I remember being shocked by this by the first time I traveled to Brazil about a decade ago. You know, I turned on the radio hoping to finally get a taste of an authentic foreign culture different from the United States. But to my horror, half of what was available was Rihanna and Lady Gaga. So then I retreated to the country and worked on a family-owned organic coffee farm. And there, you know, I got somewhat of the immersion I was looking for, cut off from the globalized media. And three, global warming and other forms of ecological degradation are having a disproportionately heavy impact among poor communities of the global south. This, in turn, creates waves of environmental refugees overwhelming nearby communities. And hey, be however daunting these challenges may be at the end of the day, don't be tempted to sit around and wait for the new, decentralized, eco-village-friendly world to appear. Because like I said before, the global ship is coming down, and it's coming down fast. So having at least a semi-life raft is better than having nothing. And then Dawson mentions another general challenge for all areas of the world being the global shift towards individualism in society at large that is in turn reflected as one of the primary internal challenges for eco-villages once they've been created. This manifests itself by high turnover rates of members of or people demanding more private space or more, you know, more conflicts or a weakening of the social glue that keeps everyone together. And fortunately, I found myself in the middle of this example. You know, I was hired on as an engineer for an aspiring community project in Panama, which also attracted a lot of media attention at the time. It was also the very first community that was primarily of residents of the U.S. And I came aboard right after my coursework in Finhorn. And, you know, the community made sure to not call itself an eco-village, but it was still a community nonetheless. And the social and economic structure was set like that of a standard company in the U.S. You know, you have your big boss, then going down the hierarchy, you have management, then so on and so forth. And essentially the whole thing fell apart when I was there. It lacked the social glue and the shared values amongst those living there. You know, that was it. Sure, everyone agreed about sustainable living, but that was the extent of it. If somebody had an issue and complaint, they were fired and forced to leave. If two individuals had a conflict, it blew up into a fight with long-lasting bitterness because conflict mediation was not at all talked about and empathetic communication was not part of the curriculum. And from a firsthand perspective, it was horrific to be inside what they called a pressure cooker of emotions. And then gasoline was poured over the fire, you know, as the big boss man wanted to make a documentary series with Viceland, hoping it will, you know, shed its colors over the world. But it did the exact opposite. Intentionality was sabotaged there by the saturated egos when the cameras started to roll during our day-to-day activities. Trust me, I've gotten very intimate with the ugly side of community development. But hey, it's still better, though, to try than to not try at all. But like any venture, learn from the mistakes. And these mistakes don't have to be your own. Therefore, study what could go wrong. Like with any sickness or disease, preventative medicine is the best medicine. Establish the appropriate social and economic structure beforehand. And these topics are so dense that I'll dedicate further episodes to these later on. Just know that they are the make or break, trust me. So the particular challenges for whatever your situation may be can vary, but just know that the trail has already been blazed. Reach out and learn all the examples you can of what to do and what not to do. So let's go back one more time to placing the most appropriate definition that most effectively captures in the fewest words possible all that eco-villages represent. Since this concept is so new and every eco-village is so diverse, as we already talked about, it's kind of like trying to tattoo a smiley face on a runaway horse. But the attempts have been made nonetheless. I've already mentioned a simple definition earlier, but I really like this one as we wrap up the summary. The definition that Dawson provides goes like this. An eco-village is a private citizen's initiative in which the communitarian impulse is of central importance, that are seeking to win back some measure of control over community resources that have a strong shared values base, often referred to as spirituality, and that act as a center of research, demonstration, and training. And another way I like to see it, I like to describe them as self-generating batteries of life that provides genuine service to the greatest and deepest needs of ourselves and of our environments. I see their value being provided through ecological restoration, strengthening community, nurturing the local economy, and deepening spiritual insight. Eco-villages are always in service of a wider goal which distinguishes themselves from the myriad of other local regeneration initiatives. They are materializations and living examples of a deep respect for equality and diversity within the confines of a finite earth. They build upon the strengths of the small-scale farmer and artisan and values these strengths as something to be built upon rather than a problem to be solved. They are the declaration of resolution against the dominant socioeconomic, globalized, debt-based, fiat Ponzi scheme paradigm of our current age. eco-villages could very well be the very answer to keep us going through these times of great uncertainty. So, hey, thanks for listening. You know, what is your impression from this? When you first heard of the word eco-village for the first time, what was your initial thought reaction? You know, what first came to mind? Let me know your thoughts. Thanks again. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Until next time. Ciao, ciao.